Senate Agriculture and Veterans Committee will come to order. Three items on the menu today, but we'll start out with Major General Larry Shelto. Give us a brief update on your Minnesota National Guard report. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
My name is Larry Shelto, Major General, the Adjutant General for the state of Minnesota. Chair Vickerman, and committee members, it's my pleasure to report the status of the Minnesota National Guard, and I'll focus primarily on the last year and the accomplishments that we've had. I'll start first with our air components. The 148th Fighter Wing out of Duluth, Minnesota, was the most deployed air wing in the United States Air Force, active, reserve, or guard. They did air sovereignty up in Hawaii and Alaska, and they are the first National Guard unit ever to escort a Russian bear outside the U.S. airspace. And they just came back from a tour in Iraq, providing overhead cover for the ground forces. Our 133rd Air Wing out of Minneapolis is just completed its deployment in Afghanistan, doing delivery, precision dropped sites. They also were the base for the Republican National Convention, using their facilities and so forth for all agencies, federal and state. And both units received an outstanding unit award citation, making each of them, both our units, in the top 10 of the United States military in their categories. The Army has been extremely busy also. As you're well aware, our aviation battalion came back from a year's mission in Iraq. The 149th and the 151st Engineer Companies completed their rotation, their second, in fact, coming back from a tour in Iraq. The 34th Aviation Brigade has deployed and is currently in Iraq. The 34th Infantry Division and the 1st of the 151st Field Artillery both are in preparation for the deployment. All of you, I believe, have been invited to attend the deployment ceremony on February 10th at the Excel Center, and it's an event I strongly encourage you not to miss. It's going to be special. State active duty continues in support of our civilian authorities. We have deployed over 9,000 Minnesota Guard, 9,000 man days during the past year. Typically, it's flood fighting, missing persons, winter storm assistance, so forth. But most significantly, we had 1,700 guardsmen in preparation and support of the Republican National Convention. The vast majority, you've seen about 150 of them in the media, but the remainder were doing infrastructure and backup support for our law enforcement agencies. Also, what didn't make the media was the fact that on a two-day notice, we shipped out 300 of our ready reaction force to Washington State. They stayed at A.B. Hill, the fort in Virginia, in support, and they were the response force should anything have happened during the inaugural. As we look forward, the new normal is a phrase that we are looking for, and these are the objectives that you'll see in the back of the our annual report. What we have is well over 19,000 deployments all across the world, and these young people and these soldiers and airmen that are coming back are not going to go back to the old way of doing things, one weekend a month and so forth. They're highly trained, they're highly skilled. An integral part of that new normal is our Beyond the Yellow Ribbon program that has received national attention and is now a model and federally funded. The Citizen Warrior, we have the best recruiting guard in the nation. We're at a roughly 121% strength, and that includes even them ratcheting up stricter requirements. We are enhancing our capabilities, both in the groundwork and the emergency response, and leveraging the opportunities with technology. I'm just proud to announce I got a call about a half hour before Camp Ripley just received, again, the National Conservancy Award from the Department of Army. This is 2 years. They've won this now. They won it in 07 and now in 09. and they will be competing for the Department of Defense worldwide status. And also we have international engagements shortly within the next few weeks here. If you were to go to Camp Ripley, you would see Minnesotans training with Norwegians, Danes, Swedes, and Croatians in there. And concurrently, we'd then throw you on a plane and take you to Norway, and you would see the same group training there. Also, we have, as we speak, in Croatia at this time, excuse me, it is Croatia at this time, 12 of our Minnesota National Guardsmen who will be working with Croatians, and then upon completion of training will go into Afghanistan to prepare for training of the Afghan National Army. With that, in conclusion, we're ready. We are well prepared. 95% of our budget is from federal coffers, if you will, which has enabled us to leverage significant dollars in the hundreds of millions of dollars annually to benefit the state of Minnesota, as well as prepare us to do our federal missions that I've identified. Further questions until we complete? This time, Terry Palmer will give you a review of our budget.
Thank you, General. Mr. Chairman, committee members, staff, Terry Palmer, Comptroller for the Department of Military Affairs. I would like to give you a very high-level review of our budget request from the state side. As the Adjutant General said, the National Guard has never been busier. 95% of the total budget for military affairs is federal funds, but those portions of the federal funds that come through the state's accounting systems and through procurement and contracting, which varies between $40 and $80 million depending on construction, they require some state agency action. So the state funding has a significant impact on the ability of the National Guard to complete its state and federal missions. In this case, the governor's biennial budget request for the Department of Military Affairs has a 0% increase for 10 and 11. When we prepared our budget, our goals were to support the missions of the Minnesota National Guard. We wanted to make sure we had sufficient staff to respond to the needs of soldiers and units ordered to state active duty, conduct the business and coordinate with state government, plan and prepare for state emergencies, support the National Guard members and their families, and finally, to support National Guard programs. Another one of our budget goals was to provide clean, safe, and functional facilities for National Guard members to train in. We also want to ensure that our enlistment incentives program is adequately funded and that we use those resources in a strategic manner. We also want to make sure that we can provide the state match for those federal programs that require a state match so we can acquire those additional federal funds. In terms of our strategy, we had to balance our staffing needs against the budget, of course. We've applied those personnel resources to the most critical areas of our operation and reduced staff through attrition where possible. We're also trying to make wise use of the energy that we have for our state-owned facilities and state-supported facilities. And we're designing our new facilities to be more energy efficient. We continue to examine all the areas of the budget to ensure we are making wise, strategic use of the limited state resources. And we're assessing the budget impact on those federal programs and accounts that require state interaction. So briefly, our FY 10 and 11 base budget, we have three appropriations. Maintenance of training facilities is $6.66 million per year. The general support appropriation is $2.366 million per year. And the enlistment incentives program is $10.348 million per year for a total of $19.374. In the maintenance of training facilities, that $6.66 million, about $2.6 million of that is being programmed for energy costs for state-owned facilities and those facilities that require state support at Camp Ripley. We're projecting just over $1 million in requirements for a federal match for the two air bases and for the National Guard facilities at Camp Ripley that require some state match. There's also about $280,000 in a bond payment to the Armory Building Commission for construction of new facilities. There's about $707,000 in the construction and contracting department at Camp Ripley, which pays those salaries for the people that are actually executing that those federal dollars that we receive. About $250,000 is for armory facility maintenance, supervision, and then the statewide indirect costs, which leaves us about $1.68 million for facility maintenance and repair, which works out to $22,500 per facility, which unfortunately is about 91 cents a square foot for those 63 armories that we'll be taking care of. And those guys do a very good job of stretching those dollars and making sure we can use federal money where it's available. A general support budget of $2.366 million. About $1.6 million is for compensation costs for the adjutant general and the staff. We pay about $500,000 per year in rent for the Veterans Service Building. And we pay about another $20,000 for additional utility costs at the Veterans Service Building because we have a network operations center for the computer systems. In terms of the enlistment incentives program, the total budget, again, was just over $10 million. Even with the carry forward that we have, we're expecting the funding to be very tight. We've added two new programs. One was the spousal tuition reimbursement program. The other one was the extension of those tuition reimbursement programs to members of the National Guard who had completed their service and left the military, so they got 2 years plus time served to use those benefits up. And on the plus side, which we think will help reduce the pressure on this budget, because of the extended active service that the members of the 34th Division had, many of those individuals will be eligible for the GI Bill under the normal circumstances. So we hope that will free up some state money to take care of those other needs. We also have the reenlistment bonus program. Was authorized in 06, and every year we're adding more people to the maximum of 5 years of participation in the program at $1,000 per year. Again, the funding is very tight, but we will make it work. FY10 is the last year of the 5 year buckets, so to speak. So what will happen after FY10, the first year of participants will drop off, so we can add more people into the program without any additional costs again. Just to give you a little better sense of the size of the Department of Military Affairs on the state side, these numbers are as of October 08, which are probably a little different from what you'll see in the budget book when you get it. Our total agency FTE was about 282. 11 of those were funded up through some other source of income, which is primarily the housing function at Camp Ripley. And 228 FTE are federally funded. So that leaves a total of just almost 43 FTE funded on the state side. And that's only 15.2% of the total FTE count. In terms of head count, I think the budget book will show you 299. As of October 08, we had 279 employees. Only 32 of those were funded completely out of the general fund, so that's just over 11% were actually general fund funded. Our total compensation for all employees is just 15% of the total state budget, and in terms of the total compensation for military affairs, it's just over $18 million state and federal dollars, and $2.2 million of that is state money. So we do work very closely with the federal government and do a lot of work on behalf of the federal government, for which they give us grant money or cooperative agreement money to conduct that business. And that also points out the difficulty we have during times of budget reductions, that in order to save the equivalent of one salary, we would have to lay off four or five people in those programs that are federally matched, so it becomes very difficult. Mr. Chairman, that completes my overview of our budget requests from the department.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Colonel Eric Onless, I'm the Director of Government Relations. Just to point out, and I know many of you have been looking at it, this is our annual report, and it goes in a lot of detail on the things that General Shalito mentioned and also provides the results of the funding that comes in that Mr. Palmer mentioned. At this time, this concludes our brief, and we'll stand by for questions.
Major Chilto, how is the enlistment? Are you able to keep your strength up, or just kind of curious?
Mr. Chairman, we are on a waiting list. You have to go back to the Vietnam era and the draft to have that situation. We're meeting and talking about it, but we are at, like I said earlier, 121% strength. And what we're doing is scrubbing the ranks, making sure that everything is counted and correct. But we're embarrassing the rest of the nation.
Now I'm going to ask you one question. It might be kind of touchy, but I come from my apartment. I come by the Armory downtown and by here. If I see one male, I see four females. So how many females? Is there quite a few? I'm just curious. A lot of females enlisting in, you know? Maybe, I'll get it another time.
I think 16%.
Okay.
By the way, one of the points I want to, for the females in the group, on December 25th of last year, or 7.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. There was the first all-female aviation mission completed in Iraq. That includes preparing the aircraft for flying, fueling it, occupying it, flying it, and doing it for about 16 hours during that day and then taking it back. So
okay.
We're quite proud of that also.
Well, we all should be proud of that, just step forward that way. Women are tough. I knew that. So I grew up through, and I got beat up by girls in school and everything else. So I know that can be awful tough. It might not look it, but be a little careful when you push it. Senator Engelbrecht, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I too echo the success of the of your report today. The 121%. I mean, that's astounding. Is that something that has been? Something that's been going on for years, or are we at the highest part? Or what? Give me a rundown about 10 years back.
10 years back, I can show you, I believe now in 10 years, every year has been a growth year. In the last 12 to 13 years, there's only one year that it was down from the previous years, and that was 26 personnel. Otherwise, it's steadily growing. The biggest spike occurred in 9/11. And after that, it was steady. And in all the convention, the most commonly asked questions are, how is your strength and how is your retention? They both are doing extremely well. And historically, I would say the number one reason for people joining the National Guard was educational benefits. Mm-hmm. I now say it's service. And then they still want their educational benefits also. But when we did the emergency mission out to Washington State, I did not get one complaint because that's why we joined the Guard. We want to be involved with the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a follow-up, you should be very proud of that, and we certainly are here. Another comment with regards to Fort Ripley, it's not in my district, but I know the amount of law enforcement personnel that go through there over the years, both state, local, and county, and I think some federal agents at different times have trained there, and that's a remarkable site, and I'm glad to see that they're in the running for whatever they're in the running for here for some kind of an award, and that says an awful lot about our state as well. So thank you very much for the report.
Senator Deal.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, General Shalito, I want to make sure I understand all these records that we're talking about, all these good things, and you mentioned you're at 121% of strength. And that's very good compared to other states. What are other states at?
They're actually doing much, much better. They have a new program. The National Guard as a total is over 100% strength. But I think the national average would be in the 95 to 96% percentile.
Okay. And, Mr. Chairman, General Shalito, I want to also make sure I understand this record that was set on December 25th, 2007. I believe that was the date you cited.
Yeah.
And you're talking about this mission in Iraq that lasted for 16 or 18 hours. It was entirely run by women from stem to stern, preparation, flight, and so forth. And that was a record. Were they Minnesota National Guard women that did that? And was that a record for the National Guard or for all the military, or what kind of record was that?
records are amazing, Senator. Excuse me. Here's what we do know. The women were made up of guardswomen from the state of Minnesota, the state of Washington, and the state of Hawaii. They were the units that were assigned to this aviation brigade. They said it just, they didn't plan it this way, which I don't believe. but on Christmas Day, they did all of this. There is no known record of any other flight like this ever occurring before that time. And it's passed the test of being, it was picked up by 42, it made Parade Magazine, picked up by 42 major newspapers across the country with a readership of over 35 million people, and no one sent an email saying, no, we were the first. So I think it's passed the public scrutiny test.
And Mr. Chairman, General Shalito, what was the mission?
The mission for the aviation, to be honest, in the crudest of terms, is they were a taxi service. For example, Representative Bachman was in Iraq at that time. So they'd pick her up at the airbase in, say, Baghdad, and then fly her to Balad, and she could visit troops, and fly her somewhere else and visit troops and so forth. The primary missions of that unit while they were there were twofold. One was doing a lot of the key leader shuttles, moving them about the country. They were most commonly engaged with small arms fire, the random pot shots, if you will, trying to hit them and see what would happen. The other major mission was, because of the increase in intelligence and so forth, they were doing, and by the way, the average pilot was doing 12 years of normal guard flying in that 1 year. But it would be all night, night vision, total blackout, fully loaded, and dropping anywhere from a company to a battalion worth of forces and surrounding and doing cordon and search, or I think the newspaper would refer to it as surgical strikes. So they were doing full spectrum operations, as we say it. But on Christmas Day, everyone felt it was going to be a quiet day, so they just took care of that mission.
Any other questions?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like
Senator
to
Neal.
Congratulate the National Guard for all our success, and thank you for the service.
Thank you.
Senator Robes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, General and gentlemen, for the report. It gives us a lot to be proud of here in Minnesota. And I'm just wondering if we can get copies of some of your report, General, that you started off with, a lot of statistics and that sort of thing. And then if we can get the details of this women's aviation mission. I think that's something that it sounds like it's news to this committee, and we're the, you know, Minnesota Veterans Committee. So I wonder how many other people across the state of Minnesota know about this. If we had women involved with this historic benchmark, you know, I think that's something we need to run up the flagpoles. So if you could at a later date get us some of that information, that'd be terrific.
Mr. Chair. Senator, yes, we will. If you could, just to humor me, open to the first page where I got a letter, but you'll see a picture with the Capitol in the background. That's me to the left, but to the right is Captain Arata, and she is the pilot that flew that mission, and she was featured with her little pink, what was it, teddy bear?
I think so.
A panther or something, and so forth as she was flying. But she flew not only these types of escort missions. She was flying in those night missions also. They're not separated because of gender. If their time was to fly, they flew.
Mr. Chair, one more thing. And, you know, as a woman veteran, I'm especially proud of women's service to the military, but proud of everyone, but especially the women stepping up to the plate. But I do want to give a hi-ho to the Air National Guard out of Duluth. I was just telling you gentlemen back there that my dad is retired out of the Air National Guard in Duluth, and sounds like they've been setting some records up there as well. So really proud of those guys.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the Air National Guard for your service. I do want to flag for members the portion in the report that talks about the Guard's environmental initiatives. And, of course, people know that Camp Ripley is a a major hub of all sorts of environmental activities, from conservation to hunting and fishing and learning, and your efforts there are appreciated. And I think we can, whatever the Environment Committee in the Senate can do to help along any of your initiatives, we extend that invitation. And also a brief comment, the Air National Guard has one of its family camps on the lake where I have my cabin, and we enjoy periodic flyovers over our lake, and it's exciting for the kids. Oh, that's a F-16 or whatever. I had a couple of sort of larger issue questions, and I don't expect totally detailed responses, but they are important to our constituents here in Minnesota and the Air National Guard. I've heard that the Department of Defense is considering cuts to the National Guard of up to $50 billion. And I just wanted to see if you, and I don't have any corroborating information, so that's why I'm asking. Obviously, the impact on that in Minnesota would be unknown, but presumably it would impact jobs, employed National Guard members, perhaps civilian contractors, I don't know. So I'm wondering if you have any information on any proposed cuts to the National Guard. And then, why don't we go ahead and answer that? And then I was going to ask you about Department of Defense repurposing and refocusing efforts and what impacts that might have on particularly the air part of the National Guard, but also the Army.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'll answer the first part of it. I think the $50 billion in cuts to the National Guard, I think that number's probably a red herring. That's almost the amount of the total National Guard budget. What I can say is that this morning the Washington Post reported that the Obama administration asked the Department of Defense to look up to a 10% reduction in their overall budget. Typically, though, as we look at that, there's a lot of ongoing discussion about that, about where it can go, because they're very conscientious as they look at programs, as they look at cutting back defense procurement. That all affects jobs. So it's very preliminary at this time. And there is a thought that, we still are involved in two significant wars overseas, and they want to make sure that they don't cut back on that. The one thing that General Shelton pointed out very well earlier, that Minnesota is well-respected throughout the country for our performance of the mission and accomplish it in an exceptional manner. As such, I think that positions us very well nationally to make sure we can sustain our force structure.
Senator, and the question you ask about what's the future going to be, I think, is one that we just continually look at. First of all, on the funding side of it, any student of history will say there's going to be a demand for a peace dividend. With the dollars that are going, with the stimulus packages and so forth, and the defense budget is the largest budget on the federal level. So we're anticipating some of those types of things. But more importantly, with Secretary Gates being sustained as the secretary, a lot of the policies are going to continue, but his policies, if you start reading his almost leaked guidance that's going out, to put up the flag and see how many people shoot at it, is talking about a softer and more there's a theory out there, we need two armies. One to go destroy them, and one to come in real quickly and fix them again. So I ask, if you are a student of this type of stuff, is to watch the mission of the 34th Infantry Division as they go into Iraq. They're going to be given the southern half of Iraq, and their mission is going to be to support the Iraqi army in doing the mission that we historically had. So we'll be mentors, trainers, providers, give them the logistics. Foreign units are more willing to go outside the wire when they know they got an American helicopter nearby to come and medevac if they get hurt. So those are the things we're going to watch. Why do I say that? All you have to do is track Bosnia, track Kosovo, track these types of things, because right now all arrows seem to point toward Afghanistan, which means the big army is going to look at ways to pull forces out of Iraq and then give them to the Guard in the mission. So that's why I'm watching that. I won't know that answer for, you know, 6 to 8 months from now.
Well, last follow-up, Mr. Chair, and interested in your similar answer with regards to the Air Force and how that will impact the Air National Guard here in Minnesota, our potential bases. I know there was some discussion at some point about closing Duluth. That would certainly impact our communities. What have you heard regarding any restructuring of the Air Force's mission? And is there a way that that could be taken advantage of? For example, have there been any discussions in Minnesota of reapproaching the Air Force with getting a C-17 contingent here, for example, or any of that? What have you heard on the impacts of what the Air Force is talking about changing?
Senator Bickman, Senator, right now the strategy that we're taking is that the first of all, the 133rd, the C-130s with the H-3 models are going to be around for a long time. So they will be pretty stable. So I don't see the F-17 or C-17s coming in to replace them. One's a prop, the other one's a jet. One carries more than the other. On the F-16 side, up in Duluth, Duluth has the oldest F-16s, Block 25s. That's always been an issue. They were on the BRAC. First, they weren't on the BRAC list. Then they were, and then they got off at the last minute. But as I stated earlier, they were the most deployed unit last year, and we've been working very, very hard. They are on the list at a minimum to go to Block 40, which would make them mainstream, and more preferably to the Block 50, which then would make them equal with the active duty. And a term you're going to hear quite often in the future is a term called an associate unit, where the Air Force is seriously looking at, and what would happen is active duty Air Force will co-locate with and live in Duluth working with the 148. The rationale for that is the Air Guard tends to have stronger expertise, especially in the area of maintenance. Duluth, for example, received the, it's an acronym, but it's the equivalent to the Safety's Baldrige Award, the first unit in the United States Air Force, period, to ever win that. That rattled the walls of the Pentagon, and it's because they had good partnerships with Minnesota Power up there doing that. So Duluth right now, and I've met with all the senior leadership of Duluth, and they have made a deliberate, collaborative decision. We want to go for it. All the winds of war are saying we have a good shot at the Block 50. We would like to do that before we try to discover something else. And basically, the main reason for that is jobs. Because once those aircraft go, a lot of maintenance jobs go with them. And therefore, it's in the best interest of Duluth. And Duluth has a very proactive citizens committee that's been supportive. And, oh, by the way, they have a congressman by the name of Oberstar that just happens to chair a committee that every state needs some of his stuff with. So, I mean, there's a lot of power up there right now.
And, Mr. Chair and General Shalito, I wasn't implying that C-134 should be replaced, but to the jobs issue, to the active duty associate force issue, as the C-17 force expands, I don't see a better place, particularly given the awards that Minnesota has received, why we shouldn't remain in the mix for that type of aircraft as well.
Any further discussion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just want to say, General Shalto, it's been my pleasure to not only have a couple of sons serve under your command, but to be able to go on a couple expeditions with not only the Air Guard, well, it was with the Air Guard, but we visited a lot of the ground troops in different places like Bosnia. The level of service that is provided by, you know, the men and women under your command is just, it's outstanding. You know, I was in the Marine Corps and very used to spit, shine, polish. You know, you follow your orders, you stand up straight, And I see a lot of that in the outfits that you guys are in charge of, and it makes a person feel pretty good. So thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Any further discussion? Not. I want to give a personal thank to you and your troops from this committee, and we will do everything we possibly can to see that the cuts aren't too bad if we have to make them, because we might have to. Right now, my intention of taking no cuts, but it's easy for me to sit here and talk smart until we get to the main thing. But seriously, we will protect you as much as we possibly can, and I think I speak for our whole committee. So thank you very much. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, sir.
Members, we're going to change direction just a little bit. We're going to take up Senate file number 240, Minnesota Land Conservation Property Tax. Senator Metzen, explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Little sidebar, I too was on a trip with Senator Murphy, and Senator Murphy and I had the distinction and the pleasure of opening the gates at the Panama Canal with the National Guard units there. So it was quite an experience. And also in 1999, that was good or bad because I had a heart attack about 6 months later, but I was able to fly an F-16 up out of Duluth. So I'm still here and kicking pretty good. So that's a couple of experiences I've had with the National Guard over the years. And as you know, I did chair this committee 10 or 12 years ago. So with that, I guess that's enough of that. But I just wanted to get those points across. Senate File 240 is... we call a Minnesota Land Conservation Property Tax thing bill that kind of creates another option for the Green Acres bill. It's a little tweaking that creates Minnesota Land Conservation Property Tax Law. It's modeled after the Green Acres program, but does provide for reduced property taxes on conservation land based on the land as in the conservation area. Allows a landowner to transfer property from the Green Acres program to the Minnesota Land Conservation Property Tax Law. The bill was brought to me by a lifelong friend, Vance Granis, a farmer from the Invergrove Heights area. Vance worked on the original Green Acres legislation in 1967. Before a lot of people were born. So Vance has a great knowledge and background of this legislation as it was originally passed years ago. And what we're trying to do here, and obviously as time passes, things progress and some of these laws need tweaking. Subdivision 4 talks about program requirements. Subdivision 7, covenant agreements. Subdivision 8 deals with the three-year, what do you call it, the crawlback or conservation value if the land changes use. So we think there's enough safeguards in here. And with that, I'll let Mr. Granis take about 3-4 minutes, if you will, and explain his situation as it relates to kind of a more of an urban issue, I believe. But Vance, you want to, with your permission, Mr. Vance.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Vance Jr. Thank you, Senator Metzen, for offering this bill. After the passage of last year's Green Acres Amendment, removing unproductive land from the Green Acres Law, some of the legislators from the House Tax Committee indicated that although they did not believe unproductive land should be part of the Green Acres Law anymore, they would consider a separate law that would protect such land. And that's how Senate File 240 and its companion House File 99 were born. Last week I submitted written comments on the need to protect unproductive land in the Green Acres Law. Won't take the committee's valuable time to repeat them here, but they do also apply to this bill. Simply put, as Senator Metzen has said, what this law does is incorporate the sloughs in the woodlands, and there are many important benefits, such as surface water treatment and groundwater recharge facilities, and the retention and sequestering of large amounts of carbon. And then to use a tax deferment similar to that in the Green Acres Law to encourage the continuation of these conservation practices. As you heard from many speakers last week, these sloughs and woodlands have been producing very significant but less readily apparent water treatment and carbon reduction benefits for many years under the Green Acres Law. Even with all the prospective funding that's generated or will be generated over the next 25 years through the approved constitutional amendment, we simply cannot acquire enough sloughs and woodlands to provide the same benefits that private property owners are now providing free to the public. There is actually a need to encourage rather than discourage these private owners to continue to provide these public benefits. As you also heard last week, most of these unproductive lands do not produce a direct financial return to the owners. In fact, it could be argued that private landowners are not only partially subsidizing environmental benefits to the public, but they're paying taxes for the privilege of providing these benefits. Senate File 240 tries to keep the cost to these owners at a reasonable level. Just a couple of specific provisions on Subdivision 4 that does allow some inclusion of agricultural land. Two reasons for that. First, as you heard from the various landowners last week, they consider their property to be an entire unit, and they want it all treated the same. Thus, under this bill, the owner can, but is not required, to include his agricultural land with the non-productive land. Secondly, because this bill includes protection for lands in the various conservation programs, and that land is generally agricultural land, Subdivision 4 does allow for the inclusion of the agricultural land. However, Subdivision 4 provides that land cannot be enrolled in both the Green Acres and the Land Conservation Program at the same time. Subdivision 7 provides that the land must be in the program for a minimum of 7 years, was included in response to the legislative auditor's report on the Green Acres Law last year, which suggested that a minimum time period provision be included in the Green Acres Law. 7 years is an arbitrary number that we picked. Some have suggested that 5 years would be more reasonable, and I don't have a problem with changing it or leaving it at the 7 years. However, I do see a need for some changes that I've developed after listening to matters on the Green Acres Law, and that would allow for a landowner to prematurely terminate the agreement under very exceptional circumstances, such as number one, in the event of the death of the landowner, the heirs might be forced to sell the property in less than 7 years in order to pay for inheritance taxes. Or number two, if the landowner's health were to deteriorate so he or she had to go into a nursing home, medical assistance regulations might require that the land be sold in order to qualify for medical assistance. I don't think either of these exceptions should be considered to be a potential loophole. And I don't believe there would be very many people that will go out and commit suicide or enter nursing homes just to try and terminate this agreement. I've reviewed Send File 240 with my county assessor, and I'll share her concerns with you. I see she's here today, and I'm sure she'll correct me if I don't properly relate these to you, but her concerns mainly related to the effective date for the legislation. She thinks it would be very difficult, if not impossible for county assessors to process all the applications that might come forward within the time frame permitted. Also, that the Commissioner of Revenue might not be able to develop the valuation method required by Subdivision 5 in time for the 2010 assessment, and that separating and valuing all these parcels of land that would be permitted under this legislation to be covered by Senate File 240 in time for the 2010 assessment just couldn't be accomplished. The dates that were put in Senate File 240 were chosen before it looked like there were going to be changes made to last year's law, maybe repeal those changes. And if those changes are made so that there isn't the immediate need for somebody to jump out of the Green Acres law and into this law, then we could push back those dates to allow for more time. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to explain this, and if there's any questions, I would try and answer.
Senator Metzen, do you have another witness, I believe?
Oh, I know the counties, I don't know if they have concerns.
Why don't both of you just stay there? We'll kind of talk this all over, if that would be okay. Come on up.
Now, if you're with me, you can sit out. If you're. I think you're sitting down regardless.
Pretty hard. Well, it's pretty hard to argue with the president.
Yeah. Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Efforts. I'm the Assistant Hennepin County Assessor, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. And I guess we did have a couple of concerns with this bill. I just wanted to kind of state our position from the association that we believe that we support the principle of ad valorem taxation. That means that we want taxation based on market value. We believe that that provides for a fair and equitable tax base. It's also accountable and justifiable with sales being used for similar properties. It's understandable to taxpayers and provides a degree of measurability. MAO believes that the adjustments to market values, such as limitations on assessors' market value or acquisition values or deferments, creates inequities between taxpayers. MAO also supports the classification and consolidation, and that helps to create a more understandable system for all taxpayers, and it helps to streamline administrative costs to local governments. We just feel that this bill might be a little difficult for assessors and certainly the Department of Revenue, as previously stated, to administer. We feel that there may be unintended property owner benefits from this bill that might be overly broad, and that's basically what we have to say.
Chairman, I believe that the environmental concerns and the wetlands and the sloughs and open space considerations that we better look more deeply at override some of these arguments. I think we can work these things out, but you lose these wetlands, you lose these sloughs, you lose this open space. Quite frankly, they're gone forever. They are gone forever, and we can't, as a society and a state, we can't afford to do that.
Senator Ropes, you have your hand.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Metzen, thank you very much for bringing this bill. I think it addresses a lot of concerns and the conversation we've had over the last many months talking about the changes to the Green Acres legislation. And I think it's a good bill. The only sticking point is the deadline, were this to pass. And I wonder if I could hear from the Association of Assessing Officers what would be a timely deadline or a time frame that you're able to work within if we pass this bill?
Well, as far as the deadline for the year for implementation, well, certainly 2010 assessment would probably be, if it were to be passed, that would be the first time that we could possibly take a look at administering this.
Okay, Mr. Chair, well, that's helpful because I think one of the things we heard from your organization on the Green Acres changes last year was that the implementation period came up too quickly and you couldn't get the assessments done and that sort of thing. So I'm just wondering, Senator Metzen, if we were to push out the start date or the effective date, would that be
that would be
acceptable to you?
We could do that. I believe, Senator Chaudhry, did your committee ask for this bill, too, probably?
I think so.
I think they did. I think we have a little time. If we could successfully get it out of here, which I hope you will do, we've got another stop for sure, and I promise you we will look at that date. Maybe that is not workable. So,
thank you.
Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I like this idea, but I'm wondering, we already have a very complicated property tax system anyway, and I'm just wondering if these ideas couldn't be merged with the Green Acres, with the revised Green Acres program that we're going to be passing, and we get Senator Scully talked into it. It seems like it would be a little easier to have one expanded program called Green Acres rather than two programs that are somewhat similar.
Chairman and Senator, I'm not married to how we get it done, but I am kind of married to the fact that we should get it done. So if it goes another path, and we've already worked with Senator Scoy and my witness here on a couple, two, three occasions, and my goal, I'll say it for the second time, is to pass this kind of a measure. Now, if it's in with something else, just so that something else gets passed, we'll settle for that. But I understand there could be a couple of trails going here, and maybe you want to put it together, and that's up to you guys and gals.
Any further discussion? Senator Scully.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Mr. Grannis, I don't want to speak for the department, but I think what the Green Acres bill currently and pre-2008, that death, divorce, and marriage are not reasons for reevaluating Green Acres qualifications. So those, you know, if a spouse dies or something, that's not going to institute a Green Acres reevaluation. I think that's what it was. And current to the change in law of 08, transfer to a child was also included in there. And I think there's some discussion about bringing that provision back.
Any further discussion? Senator Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Scoy, this bill would wind up in your committee anyway, wouldn't it? If we pass it out of this committee?
If this bill passes, it goes to Chaudhry's Environment and Natural Resources.
And then to taxes.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ropes, eventually I would believe this would have to go through the tax committee.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Engelbrecht.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know exactly how to ask this question, but I have a constituent that meet with an assessor available here. Maybe you can answer this. With the Green Acres program the way it was in the past, I have somebody that had a lot of lakes in my district, and property was owned across the lake, was at that time included in the Green Acres program. Under the new bill, it was not included, and they wouldn't be able to include it because there was a separation of the property from the lake, from one side of the lake to the other. And I was told by this person that they would still include it if it was a river that actually separated the properties. Do you know anything about that?
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know about that particular situation.
Mr. Hagan?
I might not answer that.
Mano.
Now, are you with us?
I will remain standing. Okay. Mr. Chairman, members, my name is John Hagan. I'm Assistant Director of the Property Tax Division. And I hadn't actually intended to testify on this bill, but there are a couple of issues. With respect to your question, Senator, I can't imagine why the contiguity of a farm would be broken up simply because it was intersected by a lake, unless the lake was of significant size like Mille Lacs or a lake of that consequence. But a lake should not break up the contiguity. Neither should a river, neither would a road. Without knowing more about that, I could certainly look into it, but that doesn't make any sense to me.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, so that would be a local tax assessor's determination then?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it would be a local tax assessor's determination. We'd hope they'd look to us for guidance if there was some issues with it.
Thank you.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, while I'm here, I'd like to weigh in on a couple other issues on this bill. And I certainly understand the desire to try to protect wetlands and woodlands and things like that, and certainly as Minnesotans we value that. The concerns I have is one of the key problems we had with the Green Acres provisions as it existed prior to last year's changes was how we would come up with a valuation of the non-agricultural lands, the wildlands, and how we could come up with a valuation that would reflect the value of that property to the farmer. This language actually requires the commissioner to develop a fair and uniform method of determining values for each county to value these properties. And we certainly could come up with a value if we were so ordered, but it would be anything but fair and equitable. It would be basically just a value that we arrived at based on some kind of criteria that would have to be determined. But there, in our mind, we came to the conclusion that one of the problems with the existing Green Acres language was there was no way to put a fair and equitable value on non-agricultural or non-productive lands and what value that would give to the farmer.
Any other questions?
You're out of here.
Senator Roach moves that Senate File 240 be recommended and passed and be referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee. Any further discussion? Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roach, did you want to change the date?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, I think we'll leave that for, it sounds like it's going to get tuned up in the Tax Committee anyway and possibly merged with other bills, so I'll just leave that to them. Okay, Senator Metzen said he could reconsider.
Yeah, well, you'll have our pledge that we'll work on that. I don't know what the right dates are.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All adopted.
Thank you. Thank you, members.
Yeah. All members, before we get started on this Green Acre fix-up bill, there's a lot of legislators worked very hard in this committee to see that this bill got passed, and I don't want to take that away from you. Senator Ropes, you were a leader. Senator Phoebe, Senator Lynch, Senator Olstein, Senator Cooch, and Senator Scoy. And so I want to thank all of you that to try and get this bill passed if we can today, but we're all on the same path. Senator Scoy, you're up on the front.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think before I start talking about Senate File 386, this is the first committee that this bill has been to. And in order to get the bill in the state that I'd like to offer the A1 amendment. Members, this is the amendment that reverses the decision that was made last year to not have Conservation Reserve Program and other conservation lands qualify. This would allow conservation lands to qualify for Green Acres if this is adopted.
Senator, maybe you could wait a minute till they get it passed out. Scoy, do you move the adoption of A1 amendment? Senator Scoy?
I move the A1 amendment.
Moves adoption of the A1 amendment, get the bill in order that he wants it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Adopted. Now we're on the A1 amendment. Now explain it, Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Well, I'm here today with the fix to the Green Acres fix that I've been working on for a couple of years. And, you know, we had a lot of testimony in committee last week on this bill. Listened to a lot of people who talked about issues that have come up with regard to the changes that we made to bill in the 2008 Tax Committee. I would like to say that this is going on now the third year that we've been working on the Green Acres provision. And for those of you that were here, and some of you weren't here, or one of you anyway, in 2007 we did a Green Acres fix. It was in the tax bill that the Senate voted on. Went to conference committee, came back from conference committee, was voted on by the Senate, and went to the governor. The governor vetoed that bill. And so those provisions didn't pass into law. Last year, we picked up those provisions and started working on the Green Acres bill again. And there were some differences there. In 2007, we did include an income criteria, which we did away with in 2008. But for the record, I'd like to say that this is not something that just came out of the conference committee last year. This has been an ongoing discussion that the tax committee and the property tax division has been having for a number of years, and have held a number of hearings on this. And you know, when we started working with this program and trying to figure out a way to make the program fit so that it could be implemented in all 87 counties across the state, we started out trying to figure out a way to provide a valuation mechanism on ag land as well as the non-productive ag land that was currently enrolled in Green Acres, and have that those formulas apply statewide. And we have, the department has been working, and a number of us have been working on this, and we have come up with a mechanism that we think is a pretty good starting point for valuing the ag land, where we take the southwest corners where most of the sales in that part of the state are ag-based, and then we apply a factor to the sales of land in your particular county or jurisdiction and come up with a median ag base value that we can then use to determine whether the parcel should qualify for Green Acres. As you heard Mr. Hagen testify just a minute ago, with regard to the non-productive ag land that is currently enrolled in Green Acres across the state, it's extremely difficult to come up with any mechanism for valuing that that would be uniform and would work in a program that would apply statewide. We really did a fair amount of work on this. And then when the legislative auditor's report came out and we reviewed a lot of what the legislative auditor recommended, we went back to the original purpose of the program. The legislative auditor states that the purpose of this program is to equalize taxes on agriculture lands. Now, everybody views agriculture a little differently, but to my way of thinking, in order to have a parcel of agriculture land, you have to have some kind of production on that land. I mean, it can be a crop or a cow or a goat or milk or hay or pasture, but it has to be something related to agriculture. And so when we got going on this again last year, we kind of came around that maybe this non-productive land that is impossible to come up with a valuation mechanism doesn't belong in the Green Acres program at all. And so that's kind of how we got to where we are. And, you know, I know it's causing a fair amount of consternation for people that are currently enrolled in the program. But, you know, if, you know, even with the changes that we made in last year, where we grandfathered a large number of these people into the program, anybody who was in the program prior to the changes in law is going to stay in the program. All they have to do is give their intent this summer or fall sometime, and they will be in the Green Acres program. Nobody's kicked out. The only time that there would be a reevaluation of whether their non-conforming parcels would be able to stay in the Green Acres program is if there was a sale to, a sale and or a land transfer. And with Senate File 386, there would be some conditions that would not bring about that reevaluation, death, divorce, marriage, and we have returned to the language that was in the original Green Acres contract that these Green Acres participants signed, where transfer to child or children would also not bring about the reevaluation of program benefits. So that's kind of where we're at. There's been a lot of work done on this. I think we've made some progress. I know there's a lot of discussion going on in the legislature and around about repealing the changes that were made in 2008. And, you know, I guess we'll get a chance to reevaluate that. But I would like to remind you, when the assessors sat at this table last week, a couple of the issues that they brought up. Difficulty to assess non-productive land. Well, that's exactly the problem that we've been dealing with these parcels all along. The other issue that the assessors brought up was that they will have parcels in their jurisdiction that will be mirrors of each other. One will be here and one will be here. One will have been enrolled in the Green Acres program prior to 2008 and be getting completely different tax treatment than the other parcel, even though the two parcels are exactly the same. That is a pretty fundamental fairness problem that should be addressed.
He wants to testify.
As long as there's a grandfather provision in with respect to Green Acres, you are going to have that fairness issue that we're going to have to try to figure out. But having said all of this, I guess I'll go through what the Senate File 386 does, and then we'll see what the discussion and what other amendments are. On page 1, section 1, 3A, this language dealing with any part of it, this is an effort to clarify that only the part of the green grandfather land that was sold would be eligible for the tax deferment as long as it's not producing a crop. Subsection B, that's the returning to a 3-year clawback from the 7 years that was in the conference committee report that became law last year. That's on, carries over onto page 2. Page lines 5 through 7, that's the language that brings the son or daughter, child or children language back into effect, that the son or daughter wouldn't result in reevaluation of benefits. Lines 22 through 25, we've had a fair amount of discussion about folks that are going to potentially have parcels that are in the Green Acres program that the landowner might choose to not have in the Green Acres program. They would withdraw them from them. I don't know, with the change in the clawback provision from 7 years to 3 years, if there will be as many as there would have been. But many of these parcels, a sale wouldn't have occurred with them, so there wouldn't be any income generated to pay back the income taxes. This is a provision that gives folks kind of a, I don't know why I can't come up with the word anymore, but it's a time frame where you can withdraw your programs from Green Acres with zero payment, which would be different, a change from when they originally signed up the 3-year clawback. Now they, people could get out of the program with no payback. And it's an effort to try to get these non-conforming parcels into conforming status. What else? Then on page 3, lines 5 through 12. And, you know, members, if in my opinion, if we could fix this paragraph so that it fit all the circumstances that we would want Green Acres land to have, we wouldn't need a grandfather. But as we've worked on this, it's apparent that there are some parcels of land that are currently enrolled in Green Acres that would suffer a negative consequence if we do not do the grandfather. So we're going to propose to leave that in place for now. But what this does is this gives direction, and we've changed the may to must, but we're giving direction to assessors that when you have parcels that are impracticable to separate and unlikely to be sold separately from the ag land, those parcels will be in the Green Acres program. And it's sloughs and wooded wind shelters and, you know, this acreage abutting ditches, that language is primarily referring to grassy buffer strips and that kind of stuff. We've included rocks and ravines, that sort of thing in there. We're trying to clean that language up in that provision. And then with the A1 amendment, we have included the CRP land, and we are making this effective for the assessment year 2010. And so, Mr. Chairman and members, that's the Senate file. It's an attempt to fix some of what was passed in 2008. And I guess we'll stand for questions.
Senator Scoy, I have two witnesses. Let's take those witnesses, then we'll come back to the committee. The first one is David Dayton from St. Michael's. And the other one is Keith Carlson. So if they would both come up there and... we'll hear from David first, and next would be Keith. So welcome to the committee, sir, and state your name for the record.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Dayon, D-A-Y-O-N. No T. Sorry, that's those other people that got the money, not me. I'm a farmer. I'm a horse farmer. I've owned my farm for 40 years. I purchased it in 1969 after I was discharged from the military service. My farm currently consists of four separate horse barns, the capability of housing a minimum of 40 head of horses. The farm is used for boarding of horses, for breeding, foaling, preparation for sales, layups, and post-surgical rehabs.
Thank you.
I'm required by the state to register with the county as a livestock feedlot. I'm required by the state statutes to obtain a livestock health certificate to move these animals within the state and out of state. This is how I make my living. This is my job. I recently received the memo that's been handed out to you from my county assessor. Excuse me, from my city assessor. Be brief. Horses are not an agricultural product. They are a pet. That's interesting. Farther down, under excerpts from the previous letter, horses are not considered livestock. Based on a lawsuit pertaining to sheep, we've decided that this does not constitute, raising horses does not constitute as agriculture. Now, I'm not quite sure I understand how the raising of sheep correlates to the raising of horses, but the raising of sheep doesn't change at all. But whatever. According to a University of Minnesota study dated 2004, there are approximately 155,000 horses in the state of Minnesota. That study was done in 2004. I've done some checking and talked to various different American Horse Council and the like. We think that a more realistic number currently would probably be somewhere between 200,000 and a quarter of a million. But even at 155,000, horses are the third largest livestock class in the state of Minnesota. Hardly what I would consider to be pet quality stuff. I've got just three questions about this bill. How can the language of this bill be construed to reclassify the third largest livestock class, even though it's not even mentioned in the bill? But I've been notified that under the terms of the Green Acres bill, my farm is being reclassified as residential. I don't understand that. How can this bill be used to change this classification? As I said earlier, how can a court case pertaining to sheep reclassify horses as something other than livestock. And specifics to the bill under on page 5, line 6, it defines the commercial boarding of horses is done in conjunction with the raising and cultivating of agricultural products as defined in Class 1. Horse boarding is the raising of horses. That's what we do. We board horses when we raise them. I board stallions for other owners. I board the mares that are being bred to those stallions. I board the horses that I'm prepping for sales. I board all my rehab horses. I board over 50-some mares a year to foal them out for people. That's what horse raising is. I mean, it's maybe it's not the same as milking a cow, but that's what you do when you raise horses, is you board them. And I don't understand why horses and only horses are the only ones that have to be done in conjunction with raising or cultivating another agricultural product as defined in Clause 1. And Clause 1 lists livestock, and horses are livestock. So I'm supposed to raise horses in conjunction with horses to qualify for this bill. I don't understand. The language is very ambiguous. And
Mr. Hagan, maybe you can shed some light on what's going on.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. If I understand what I think I understand, this epitomizes a lot of the problems we're having with this whole discussion on Green Acres. A lot of the information is misinformation, and it's not in context of this issue at hand on Green Acres. Mr. Dan, if I believe I'm correct, has his acreage is less than 10 acres?
Yes.
As an acreage less than 10 acres, it would not qualify for Green Acres now. It would have never qualified for Green Acres. The minimum requirement for Green Acres in 1967 and ever since was 10 or more acres. Consequently, Mr. Dayon's property never could have or certainly should have received Green Acres. Additionally, I don't have a disagreement or an argument with Mr. Dayon, but the reality is what his concern is and what his problem is with the ag definition. And this ag definition has been unchanged with respect to horses for, I'm thinking, decades. So this is not a new issue. It's an issue that's gained a lot of traction now, but it has nothing to do with Senator Scoria's Green Acres or even the Green Acres prior to that time. It has to do exclusively with the ag classification, that's been handed down throughout years of legislative activity. It is not a new thing.
Okay, let's get Mr. Carlson up there now, and we'll hear from him.
Mr. Chair, I think we should let the witness again speak, but I just want to say, to my knowledge, there's nothing in the work that we have done the last 2 years or what I'm proposing to do this year that has anything to do with horses or them. That's a separate classification. We're not dealing with that at all. But I think he should have the opportunity to speak one more time if he's got something more to say.
That is my question, Senator Scoia. But this bill is what generated this memo, which in turn wants to change my classification. In answer to the assessor's question, I happen to have a peculiar situation where I'm landlocked and unable to acquire additional acreage. And at the time that I applied for Green Acres, the county assessor requested that I supply 3 years of Schedule F farm income, which at that time was used as a benchmark, which I did, and he had no problem with it. Horse raising is an intensive use of the land and because of the way the horses are raised, does not require a large amount of acreage. Most of the horses are stall confined for show reasons, for training purposes. You're trying to maintain cone conditions. You're trying to maintain a strict diet with them so you don't turn them out like you would most herd animals. Granted, you can. I'm not saying you can't, but I'm just saying that in a profitable situation, a money-producing raising of horses, you usually don't, because you have large indoors arenas for training these horses and you control their environment, so there's no need for large amounts of acreage. But in retrospect to what we're discussing here, I went back in my 07 and 08 Schedule Fs. In 07, my Schedule F income was $190,000. In 08, my Schedule F income was $238,000. That's not bad income for me as far as I'm concerned, and I don't realize why I don't understand why I need to do anything else in conjunction with this. I have a money profitable situation raising a type of livestock, and I don't understand why I need to do anything else in conjunction with that.
Mr. Coy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I honestly don't know whether horse farms are where they fall in the ag classification. But I do want to tell you that when we had this discussion with regard to smaller parcels that are intensively farmed, and I want some of you to remember back to the discussion last year, we were trying to include a wide variety of agriculture in the ag classification. And we talked about these farm-to-market farms that were providing produce to the farmers market. Now, many of those are smaller than 10 acres, so they wouldn't qualify for the Green Acres program, but they should receive the ag class rate of 0.5 versus the class rate of 1.0, which he would end up with if he's classified as residential. So I don't, this, you know, what we've done with the Green Acres really shouldn't have any effect, but this might be an issue that this committee should be looking at, and, you know, somebody should pick this up for horses and draft the bill and get it through this committee to the tax committee so we can take a look at it somewhere.
Thank you, Senator Scoy. Senator Dill, I'll recognize you, but I don't want a two-hour sermon on sheep.
That'd be good.
Senator Dill, that wasn't nice.
How about tail docking?
You're the expert.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just want to ask the witness a question here, because reading this document here, if you produced anything else on that land you've got besides horses that's considered an agricultural product, it looks to me like you would qualify. Do you bale any hay? Do you have any fruit trees or carrots or anything out there?
I don't have any goats. I don't have any llamas. I don't have any ostriches. I don't have any sheep. I don't have any goats. I don't need to raise any hay. One of the unique things about raising horses is that you need a high quality of hay at all times. So rather than worry about whether or not I'm going to get hay rained on, worry about putting it up or anything, I'm at the local tested dairy hay auction with the rest of the farmers, buying my hay by the semi-load. I buy 27 ton at a time, and I don't have to worry a thing about the weather. I don't have to buy any equipment. Works very good for me.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, a way to get around this is to either change the law or for this gentleman to get into the production of something else in addition to his horses. That it could be vegetables, grains, hay, honey, carrots, dairy cattle. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things. How about some chickens?
Don't quite understand why I have to raise another product just because I got horses.
Mr. Carlson, is he here? Come on up.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, members, this letter, too, and I regret it, not because I don't think it's correct, but I regret it that it was in response to simply a generic question about raising horses. It was not at all specific to Mr. Dan's operation, and if it had been, I'm not sure, but we may have come with a different answer, but it was just a generic question about raising horses, and this was our response. And I think it's maybe taught me a lesson to not, in our effort to try to be helpful working with assessors, the lesson for me is we should be much more careful providing answers to questions that are not specific, and we've already taken steps to correct that issue. But the letter is fine. It was a generic question. The answer is correct, but as you know, there are specific instances which cause you to deviate from the generic response.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Carlson. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm executive director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, whose membership includes 13 of the larger counties in the state of Minnesota, many of which have substantial green acres acreage within them. First, I want to thank the author. I think he's made a substantial step towards addressing the issues raised by last year's Green Acres legislation for the existing enrollees. I just have a few suggestions to hopefully make the subject a little bit better. The first of those is with regards to Section 1, Paragraph C. The bill provides that transfers to a son or daughter of the owner will not invoke the repayment provisions for property that got split classified between the 2A and the 2B. This would generally be the situation which would be affected by this clause. I would just suggest to you that you want to expand that to include anybody who meets the qualifications for Green Acres in general, which generally has the a language provides here, a son, daughter, or sibling, but it also includes somebody who is a member or a participant in a qualified farm operation under Section 500.24 of the statutes, which would include a family farm corporation, a limited liability farm. It's quite possible that in estate planning situations, the farm may currently be held has a sole or joint tenancies type situation, but that they may decide to create a family farm corporation or one of the other qualified entities to affect the transfer of the property to a future generation. And what I would suggest to you, certainly we would not like to see that type of situation to precipitate the repayment. The only other suggestion we have deals with the issue of the valuation of the 2B property, the non-productive land that continues to qualify for Green Acres under the grandfather clause. Right now, current law provides that this property is supposed to be valued by a unique index that is the change in the value of property in the entire county compared to the prior years. This addresses, you know, frankly, the situation that Senator Scoy already identified, that it's relatively hard to value this property. But I would suggest to the committee that the solution that was came upon last year of using just the appreciation of property in the county as a whole is not the correct answer. That it's better to just look to the current law of basically what the property commands on the open market will be true for the other 2B property. So that's our suggestions. Again, we appreciate Senator Scoy's efforts in this area and hope that the bill will go further in the process.
Mr. Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And real briefly, I'm hesitant to expand the criteria beyond what the people that are in Green Acres and are being grandfathered into Green Acres beyond what the original contract that they signed was. Even though there might be some argument for it to make more sense, it is an expansion beyond what they signed. And remember that there are a whole other group of Minnesotans that don't get the opportunity to sign up for Green Acres in that manner. And so as you're expanding this for those people, it just is adding to the unfairness to the people that are going to sign up to Green Acres later on. With regard to the mechanism for valuing non-productive ag land, I agree with Mr. Carlson. We should revisit. That was a House provision that came into the conference committee, and you know, the Senate generally has better ideas, so we'll take a look at that. I do want to say that, you know, we're talking about agriculture land, and the reason for the Green Acres bill is because the ag land values are being driven up by land sales that are not agriculture. They're development, their recreation, for some other reason. And that primarily is on this non-productive land that these values are going up so high. Think about these fields that are intermixed with woods and nice building sites. Well, the value is not in the field. It's in the other land. And, you know, we're giving all this preferential tax treatment to this other land that's driving up the value of the ag land that we're trying to equalize the value of. And somehow that doesn't square with me,
But I guess that's there, and I just want to make sure you guys kind of think through where the increase in value is coming from, and it's coming from this non-productive land that has a lot of value for other uses. And the ag land, nobody wants to build their house out in the middle of a field, so that just kind of can stay ag land. But anyway, that's all I have to say on that. But
Senator Gill, you have a question?
Carlson does have a good point on the valuation.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment.
Senator Gill, I wonder if sometimes it's a lot better if we have that amendment out here so we can study it rather than what you can do what you want to do. But maybe you could suggest that, and it goes to another committee. Hopefully it'll get out of here and work it out and put it on down in writing. So maybe I'm the only one that can't understand it. But let's hear what it is, Senator Dillon.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, what I'd like to do is go on page 2, and on lines 2.5 and 2.6, I'd like to delete 8 words. On line 2.5, after the word transferred, I'd like to delete the words to a son or. And on lines 2.6, I'd like to delete the 4 words daughter of the owner, so that it doesn't matter who the land is transferred to or sold to, the land can still stay within in the Green Acres program.
Mr. Chair, this would mean that the preferential tax treatment that is going specifically designed, supposed to go to farmers, would then transfer to a land developer who bought this parcel simply as an investment to hold for a little while until he could develop houses on it. And I don't know if that's exactly the purpose of the Green Acres program, and I mean there might be some. Well, I really am opposed to that nature of an expansion of the Green Acres to consider any land.
Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I'm interested in preserving agricultural land, open space land, forest land, wildlife habitat land. And just to say that only farmers can access this program, I don't think that's entirely right. And on top of that, a lot of farmers can't own enough land to make a living. They have to rent land from somebody else. So if this parcel gets sold to somebody that doesn't happen to be farming it, but he's making it available to some other farmer to rent, the rent doesn't have to be so high if the taxes aren't so high. And it is a small economic incentive not to develop it, to keep it in open space. And to me, it's just another way to help provide a small economic incentive to preserve open space, ag land, forest land, and to me, it doesn't matter whether it's a farmer or not a farmer. As long as a person's willing to keep it in open space, I think he should get some kind of tax advantage.
There's Guy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, well, the land that is pasture or producing some kind of agriculture crop would be eligible for the Green Acres program and the benefit. It's only the non-productive land that's sold that wouldn't be eligible for the benefit. It's not the whole parcel. And if it's a windbreak or a ditch or a rock pile or a ravine, that's going to be eligible because that's not practicable to separate, and we're giving the assessors a must include is impractical to separate or sell. So, I mean, just because the land is sold to somebody other than a son or daughter doesn't mean it's not going to be in the Green Acres program.
Senator Scoy, on Senator Dale's amendment, did I hear you say you don't like it?
Well, Mr. Chair, yes, I'm opposed to this that large of expansion in this part of the Green Acres program.
Okay, members. On Senator Dale's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Adopted. Now we'll go back to Senator Scoy. I'll take Senator Ropes first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Scoy, I have the A2 amendment, and I've talked to Senator Scoy about this. Has that been passed out?
Want to ask him that, I think. Clarify that.
I think that's what he said.
Mr. Chair, as it's being passed out, I'll just explain the A2 amendment.
Just wait a minute until we get till the on this. I don't have the bill.
Mr. Chairman, just briefly, could you clarify, was that amendment adopted or not adopted?
We did not adopt the Dill amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I thought you said it was adopted.
Yes.
No. I said it did not pass.
Oh, okay.
Can I call for a division?
You can do anything you want to. Okay. All those in favor of the Dill amendment, raise your hand. Who's counting? All those opposed? Does not pass, right? I was right. Now.
Okay.
Now we're on. I cranked him up a little bit.
Yeah, I know. You're doing a great job.
It's always good to re-clarify. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I have the A2 amendment, and essentially this is a full repeal of the Green Acres Bill. Puts the language back to the pre-2008 Green Acres Law and Cultural Classifications Law.
Senator Oaks?
Yes.
Senator Scoy, do you have a copy?
Yes, I do, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Oaks.
Thank you. We've heard a lot of testimony over the interim and the last number of weeks and months from farmers and rural landowners across the state. In my corner of the world, we have thousands of landowners who are adversely affected by the Green Acres changes. And I appreciate, Senator Scoy, your work on tuning the bill up. I still think it needs some continued work. I'd have to agree with Mr. Carlson. We still have some valuation of 2B land that we need to have continued discussion about this. We've all heard from, I think, the Minnesota Farmers Union, Land Stewardship Project, Minnesota Farm Bureau, the Assessors Organization, MICA, AMC, I think, are all calling for repeals. So I put before you the A2 amendment. There are a couple minor things that have not been repealed from the 2008 bill, but they're just minor, non-controversial things. For example, calling on the commissioner to develop a fair and uniform method of evaluating agricultural land. We left in some language with explicit references to CRP and RIM properties, and the short rotation of woody crops, you know, to let people know that there are more things that qualify as agricultural products out there. So basically the things left in are just have not even come up and are non-controversial. Basically, this amendment is a full repeal of the Green Acres Law from last year. So I put that out there. I ask for your support. I appreciate your work, Senator Scoy. I think this bill does need continued work and continued conversation, but I would ask members to support the full repeal.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I oppose this amendment. You know, there's been a lot of work gone into this Green Acres issue. And currently, as it stands, I don't think anybody on either side is very happy, because I don't like the grandfather provision, to be perfectly honest. And, you know, if we're going to come back in a couple years, repeal all this work that was done, and come back in a couple years and take another run at this, maybe the grandfather provision won't survive the process. You know, there's stuff in here that people want now. The CRP provision is included in here. We fixed some of the majority of the issues that were brought with regard to the 2008 changes in Green Acres. But if we do the whole repeal, and you know, just because we pass or don't pass it here today, we very likely will see this on the floor. I mean, we already saw it once. Does anybody think that won't happen again? So I don't know where we're going to go, but I'm just to tell the members that just because we repeal this today doesn't mean Green Acres is an issue. It's going to go away. And in a couple of years, some legislator will decide to fix it up again, and you don't know what direction that might take. So you got to kind of balance that between what you're facing in Centerfile. I don't even remember the number of it anymore.
386.
So I oppose the amendment.
Any more discussion? Senator Shadrick.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think, Senator Skoy, I think you make some very fair points. I think they're fair points from a different point of view, that, yes, Green Acres may not go away, but at least we'll have a closer magnifying glass on the changes we make, and that perhaps wasn't entirely the case what we did with what we did last year. I'm hearing from, I don't hear just from sportsmen, I hear from farmers themselves about how the changes are having adverse effects on their operations. And so I understand that this area is complex, and I'm hip to the difficulties that assessors are having, but I'm fearing that we created more difficulties, and we and perhaps had some unintended consequences. The point about the tax benefit going to unproductive parts of parcels, I have a question about, because I have a question about what's considered unproductive and what is productive. So I know there's, with the whole growth in ethanol, there was a huge concern about lands in CRP, for example, other conservation programs, no longer being in those programs, and then they started to be tilled again. So how can we call that parcel unproductive? It was in CRP, but it went back to corn, for example. So then so it seems to me that that was productive. Now, there may be some areas where there's trees or whatever, and it's just gone on so long that it'll never be a cornfield again. And I think that was some of the concern amongst the auditor's report. But we're also seeing that there's potentially productive land that not necessarily – that may be in a conservation program now, but may not be in the future. So I think that's created confusion about what's productive and what's not. And there's a lot of – I think there's – we need to work that out. But here's the thing for me. Yes, there was an auditor's report that said, well, we intended it for farmers, row crops, fields, but now it's not necessarily – the land we're giving the break to is not necessarily row crops, fields. And I guess the question I have kind of is, so what? Does it make sense for the government to take away an unintended consequence, even if that unintended consequence was good? We like that. People were conserving land. Farmers had an ability to do the right thing that they wanted to with their land, and they need to make a profit off their land. But here was an opportunity where they could do something that they envisioned in addition to just the product that we're raising. And by the way, speaking of product, we've talked a lot about in this committee in the agriculture community about the product that we may be getting now and certainly in the future from these conservation programs, the cellulosics, the grasses. And so it just seems to me like okay, yeah, what we're doing now doesn't do what people envisioned in the 60s. And that's the auditor's job. They told us that. But what we do as policymakers with it as a result doesn't necessarily mean we turn it over on its head. Maybe we can say that, yeah, it's not doing the same thing that we intended in the 60s or envisioned, but that doesn't mean that's not a good thing. So those are the things that are swirling in my mind. You know, people here know more about perhaps green acres and agricultural productivity than me. But, you know, I have heard from a lot of farmers you know, that they want to keep this land preserved, and they're not able to. They won't be able to afford to do that under the current changes. And we have the opportunity now before all the changes from 2008 kind of really hit and people stop enrolling their property in some of these conservation programs. So, yeah, I mean, we may revisit. Maybe we'll just end up crossing out, you know, Green Acres and replacing it with Senator Metzen's title. And maybe that would make more sense to people. And maybe some of Senator Metzen's ideas would be worth inserting as well. I think we should talk about those things. So, yes, absolutely. I agree that the program is not going to be – the discussion about the program won't be going away. But I think it's worth, before the damage is done too badly, it's worth us taking a step back now that we kind of are feeling the practical effects and reassess from there. And if changes are warranted, we'll make them.
Senator Ropes, if you're offering this.
Yes, and I would just say, Mr. Chair, thank you to Senator Chaudhry for making the point that one of the big problems we have with this bill is the definition of non-productive land. And you're suggesting, I think, that all land is productive land, and we need to continue to have that conversation. So thank you very much.
Now, Senator Coring, you're next.
Mr. Chairman, I guess, Senator, if I could ask a question to Senator Chaudhry, are you for the amendment or against the amendment?
We'll find out pretty quick.
Oh.
Senator's going.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just point of information, Mr. Chair, Senator Coring,
you know
for
I think
the amendment.
I should do?
For the
repeal.
This
repeal.
Amendment.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator's going.
Senator Chaudhry. You know, maybe this should have been in the Ag Committee last year to run this through. But, you know, there's a lot of ag tax policy that doesn't go through the Ag Committee. We did the 0.55 to 0.50 tax rate change. Very significant tax policy for agriculture. It didn't come through this committee. It's tax policy. Now, maybe it should have come through this committee. It didn't. We're here today. But, Senator Chaudhry, with regard to significant tax shifts, when we are taking and taxes that are on one parcel of land and allowing that owner to shift their tax burden onto somebody else, it better not be for an unintended consequence. It better be for something real that we really want to have happen. And you know, with regard to Senator Metzen's bill, everybody who's talked to me about green acres and open space and conservation, I've said, draft a bill. Introduce the bill. Bring it to the committee, have the hearing, and let's have a debate and a discussion about the direction we want to go with tax policy with regard to conservation land. I give Senator Metzen a lot of credit for putting this together. Actually, it's pretty interesting. And I'm, you know, it's hopefully going to get off to the tax committee, and we'll take a look at it. But Green Acres is for equalizing taxes on ag land. And I just think that the conservation and the open space ought to be done in the Metzen bill.
Tenor Engelbretson, you had your hand up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is, and Senator Scoy, you know how long I've been here. I wasn't part of the discussions that went on for the changing of the Green Acres law. And I guess I'm just asking,
who was part of that discussion? Was it Senate members, House members? I guess just give me a little background on that, and if you would.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingersen, well, I don't know the process that occurred in the House, but in the Senate, we had discussion with multiple ag groups. Many of the people are sitting around right here. I had at least a dozen discussions with the assessors, and they signed off on all the changes. Well, that didn't work out so well for those guys, but they did. Had lots of discussion with members, Senator Scogin. I can look around the table at people that we talked about. We had full hearing in the Property Tax Division in 07, full hearing in the Full Tax Committee in 07, hearing in the Property Tax Division in 08, and a hearing in the Tax Committee in 08. We had multiple hearings in the Conference Committee in both 07 and 08 on Green Acres. This is not something that just came kind of slipping along at the end of session last year. Multiple public hearings published in beforehand and all of that stuff.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, so there was no commission or anything that that looked at this and brought any ideas to the tax committee?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, and I might bear with me on the years because the third year now, but the department has presented once or twice to the tax committee, and the legislative auditor presented their report to the tax committee. Beyond that, there's no coalition of organizations out trying to do this. I mentioned, I think it was Mr. Carlson, I don't remember, said, I was just trying to do the right thing, but no good deed goes unpunished. So.
Senator Scoy, I'm trying to do the right thing, and I'm trying to figure out if I should ask leadership if I can chair the early childhood. This used to be an easy committee. I got the puppy mill coming. Where did all this terrible stuff come from?
Okay, I shouldn't have said today?
That, but I couldn't help it. But on Senator Rope's amendment, A-2, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
It's adopted. Okay, now we're back to your bill, Senator Scoy.
Well,
it's up to you what
Mr.
you want
to Chair
do.
And members, there's been a significant change in Senate File 386. It's now a repeal of the changes that were made in 08, and I'll be happy to carry your initiatives forward to whatever committee is due.
Senator Scoy, it will go to Environment and Natural Resources. Senator Chaudhry. On the Scoy motion that this bill passed, recommended passing, be referred to the Environment and Natural Resources. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So adopted. Members, I think we are adjourned then.
You don't have any.